There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea and in the sky. There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world that's coming, don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, my friends, fellow progressives, activists. I am here to say, not only did I dream I saw Joe Hill last night, I also dreamt I saw everybody's friend, Pete Seeger. And we're going to occasionally feature some of his music tonight and the work of his good friend, Woody. And without any further ado, especially in the context of what we've been hearing so much about, here's one of Pete's, one of my favorites. It's called The Banks Are Made of Marble.
I've traveled around this country from shore to shining shore. It really made me wonder the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer a plowing sod and loam. I heard the auction hammer just a knocking down his home. But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door. And the vaults are stuffed with silver that the farmer sweated for. I've seen the seamen standing idly by the shore, and I heard their bosses saying, "Got no work for you no more." But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door. And the vaults are stuffed with silver that the seamen sweated for. I've seen the weary miner scrubbing coal dust from his back, and I've heard his children crying, "Got no coal to heat the shack." But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that the miner sweated for. I've seen my brothers working throughout this mighty land. I prayed we'd get together and together make a stand. Then we might own those banks of marble with a guard at every door. And we would share those vaults of silver that we have sweated for.
Thanks, Pete. Thanks a lot. And now, tonight's show, the candidate show. We've got Nan Rich, Progressive Democratic candidate for governor. We've got Debbie Jordan, a candidate for Lee County Commission. We've got Eric Gooden, who is running for the Boca Raton City Council, seat B. And then a special guest who is an activist working on the Elk River spill. But first, this news. Don't walk away, EPA. The Environmental Protection Agency is walking away after a decades-long battle with Florida's politicians and industry officials over cleaning up phosphate mining waste in an area that could expose more than 100,000 residents to cancer-causing radiation levels. Under a decision quietly finalized 2 weeks ago, the federal agency will leave it to state officials to decide the fate of sites in and around Lakeland, an approximately 10-square residential area midway between Orlando and Tampa. Hey, don't worry, they're not watching out for you. And more on another issue. And don't forget, you can always get the rest of the details by going to averyvoice.com. Avery Voice, A-V-E-R-Y, averyvoice.com to see the full news stories. Okay, next story. the next important story that I want to share with you is a real hoot because it raises some issues that clearly ring a bell with the White House. You know, Edward Snowden has been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. Two Norwegian politicians say that the NSA whistleblowers' action have led to a more stable and peaceful world order. Two Norwegian politicians say they've jointly nominated the former National Security Agency contractor, Edward Snowden, for the 2014 Nobel Peace Prize. The socialist left politician, Bard Vigar Solhjell, a former environmental minister, and Snorri Valen, said the public debate and policy changes in the wake of Snowden's whistleblowing have contributed to a more stable and peaceful world order. Being nominated means that Snowden will be one of the scores of names that the Nobel Committee will consider for the prestigious award. No word from the former Peace Prize winner. New studies of the MCHM leaks impact have been funded. Hey, they're actually going to do some studies. Oh, my gosh. Charlton, West Virginia. Researchers from three universities received emergency funding for studies of the long-term impacts of the January 9th Elk River chemical leak. Oh, by the way, in case you haven't heard the details, first it was 1,000 gallons, then it was 5,000 gallons, then it was 750,000 gallons. Oh, my God, isn't that great? National Science Foundation officials say Thursday, there's an echo in this reality, National Science Foundation officials said Thursday they've approved rapid response research grants to allow experts from the University of South Alabama, West Virginia University, and Virginia Tech to more closely examine the impacts of the chemical crude MCHM. It seems the CDC, when pressed as to why they thought that a million parts per liter was a fine safety level, they said, well, listen, the manufacturer had done a study once on some rats. And when pressed further, they said, well, I mean, it's not the best thing, and there should be more studies, but hey, you know, we may get around to it eventually. So I put a call into the CDC, and they said they'll get back to me. So I'll be holding my breath on that one. Next up, more bottled water on tap. Charlton, West Virginia. Governor Earl Ray Tomlin wants the West Virginia American Water Company to provide bottled water to the nine counties where tap water was contaminated by the Elk River chemical leak earlier this month. Tomlin wrote to Jeff McIntyre, president of the West Virginia American, Thursday afternoon after a clean water protest at the state capitol. This is interesting because, you know, all those small government guys that don't like regulation, that think that we don't need government, well, guess what? Government has been mobilized and FEMA is delivering water, and the governor has asked the people who deliver the bad water to deliver good water. Isn't that nice? So you and I can help underwrite the misdeeds of this corporation. And people say, well, listen, you know, we can't hardly ask them to do anything better because, after all, they've gone bankrupt. But what happened when they went bankrupt was their parent corporation bought the subcorporation, and, gee, it's almost as if it changed hands on paper. How about that? To date, more than 17.5 million bottles of water have been distributed to residents in the nine affected counties at an estimated cost of $889,575 to the state of West Virginia. Cool. Okay, Tom, my staff continues to receive calls from constituents and organizations requesting bottled water be made available to their communities. Well, you know, they said 2 weeks ago, hey, it's okay, you could drink the water. Then a couple of days ago, they said, well, maybe it's not so good. Maybe you should, like, consult your local doctor, because clearly he will have done the independent studies that the CDC and the National Science Foundation haven't done, you think? So your local doctor could tell you. Then they said, well, maybe it's really probably not a good idea. But then yesterday, it's okay, they busted another pipe leaking more chemicals. So isn't that cool? I have managed to to talk to one of the local reporters. Let me bring that little conversation up. I know you're really going to like it. It's pretty cool stuff. Let's see. That's Mr. Goodman. So let me go here. Da-da-da. Well, we'll have to go right by that and get something else for you. Another important story, Fukushima, I know this is going to be hard to believe, radiation levels have gone up. Oh, who could have guessed? Underground water radiation skyrockets from not detected levels to 1.7 becquerels per liter of strontium-90 and other beta radionucleotides. Antimony-125 is now showing up. TEPCO changes measurements from under analysis to out of range. That's probably not a good sign. The Wall Street Journal has stated that potentially lethal strontium-90 is moving deeper and deeper into the groundwater at Fukushima, and the levels are rising. The Asahi Shimbun says radioactive material spreading below the underground wall next to the ocean. Record high levels are being seen on the other side of the final barrier. That's the final barrier between the Pacific Ocean and, you know, nuclear power is just so safe. Let's see. Among the radioactive materials dispersed at the site, potentially lethal alkaline earth metal, strontium, poses the greatest immediate concern because unlike cesium, it doesn't get trapped in the soil and tends to accumulate in the bones of fish and animals if ingested. Strontium has been slowly moving to deeper in the groundwater, which could be moving toward the ocean. Radiation levels in the groundwater sampled from several monitoring wells have been slowly rising since last summer, and radioactive strontium has been detected since October, according to data from Tokyo Electric Power Company, which operates, if you can call it that, the Fukushima Daiichi plant. An expert says this can't be changed and it can't be stopped. Radioactive Fukushima water will continually enter the ocean, and significant discrete leaks recently show the West Coast should be alarmed at the lack of testing, and the levels should be expected to be rising for 2 years and continue to increase from there. Yeah, not so very good, huh? Okay, one more story, and then we'll get on to our first live guest. Let's see. Cincinnati isn't waiting. Cincinnati plans to shut down intake valves along the Ohio River to protect the city's drinking water from a chemical spill in West Virginia. Mayor John Cranley announced Monday that the valves will be shut for at least 20 hours beginning Tuesday night. Cranley says it'll allow the water to pass the city without any chemicals entering the drinking water supply. City plans to use a reservoir of 60 hours of treated water built up specifically following the West Virginia spill. On Thursday, a chemical used in processing leaked from the plant to nearby Elk River. Also, another county official in West Virginia said maybe they should begin to do a survey of some of the other dangers to the watershed of West Virginia. And also, this news from the Times, there was a letter to editor written by Rafael Mora Iresso, who's from the U.S. Chemical Board. And among other things, he says that the U.S. is facing an industrial chemical safety crisis, the horrifying chemical spill that recently contaminated the drinking water of hundreds of thousands of people in West Virginia is only the latest in a relentless series of disasters and near misses across the country. It's clear to me, as chairman of the independent federal agency charged with investigating industrial chemical accidents, that urgent steps are required to significantly improve the safety of the nation's chemical industry, an industry vital to our economy, yet potentially dangerous to those who live near the facilities that process or store hazardous chemicals. These facilities include the one like the Chevron refinery in Richmond, California, where aging corroded pipes resulted in a huge fire August 2012, the fertilizer plant in West Texas, where stores of ammonium nitrate exploded last year and laid waste to a large part of the town, killing more than a dozen people, sifting through the chemical plant rubble from the catastrophic accidents last year. Our board has long called on regulators to require for the industry to adopt what is known as inherently safer technology. By this, we mean using safer designs, equipment, and chemicals, and minimizing the amounts of hazardous chemicals stored and used, and modifying and simplifying processes to make them as safe as practical. Ladies and gentlemen, now, without any further ado, I would like to bring you the progressive candidate for Florida governor, Senator Nan Rich. Senator Rich, welcome.
Thank you. It's very nice to be with you. I hope people are listening. Some people are listening. I think everybody's focused on the Super Bowl.
Well, I'm sure there are some people doing that, especially right. those who really enjoy watching concussions take place.
Yes, exactly. More and more we're hearing about that, unfortunately.
That's right. Unfortunately, yes, yeah. These young men are often victimized, and very little care is taken for them afterwards. But let's talk about something important. Let's talk about the Florida governorship and the leadership that you have already begun to show that Florida needs desperately. I understand there's someone else running, but they seem to be nowhere to be seen.
Well, I will say that I'm definitely out there all around the state going to as many events as I possibly can, and I think my opponent is, focused more on some other things. I'm excited because I'm building momentum, because I'm going out there and relating and talking to and hearing from voters all across the state. I was just over in Fort Myers yesterday for a clean water rally. Folks there, you know, one of, I believe it's 16 events that took place around the state yesterday.
Yep.
With regard to this declaration for clean water and to try and begin to reverse some of the damage that's been done. Certainly through the Crist and the Rick Scott administrations with regard to our water resources and water quality. So that was kind of an exciting time. And then, yeah.
I was just going to say, we have seen your commitment. You're actually talking to Floridians. Among the top priority concerns that you're hearing from your future constituents, what are some of the, what should we say, what are the top three issues you've been hearing from Floridians across the state as you tour it?
Well, I'll tell you, number one is education. And I know that the focus generally is on jobs and the economy. But education and healthcare, for that matter, are two issues that really relate heavily to jobs and the economy. And if you go back and look at all the federal money that has not been accepted or even requested by the Scott administration, you see how many jobs have been lost, starting with the high-speed rail and then, going on to some of the monies for child abuse prevention keeping frail elderly out of nursing homes, and then finally the most egregious, which is the $51 billion for Medicaid expansion. But both of those areas, healthcare and education, really connect to jobs heavily. The University of Florida did a study on how many jobs would be created if the governor and Republican-dominated legislature took the Medicaid money, and they have estimated 122,000 jobs. Those are really good healthcare jobs, well-paying benefits, new providers that would need to come in because you can't if we took the money. With 1.2 million additional people insured, you would then obviously need more healthcare providers. So, it's only natural that and the education piece ties into it, because then you would need also your colleges and universities to provide more training and more assistance in, people being educated for those healthcare jobs. The governor, it's very distressing that, he comes out and talks about record-setting funding for education, and it's just not true. After cutting $1.3 billion his first year, putting back some of that but not all of it, talking about tax cuts as he did the other day with the AP briefing, he talked about tax cuts 24 times. We're not even back to a per pupil funding rate of that we had in 2007. So, I think people are understanding that out there. Parents all over the state have been, very concerned about the attempt to privatize public education by turning schools over to for-profit management companies. So, this is a big issue for people all around the state. So that issue, healthcare, basically people are struggling still, even though we've had obviously some turnaround. The types of jobs that people are able to get are not ones that provide for health care. And kids are worried. I mean, people are worried about getting health care coverage for their children and, you know, being able to make ends meet. So, you know, these are big issues. Despite what polling may show about Obamacare, the bottom line is that we have 1.2 million people that could be covered if our state and our governor and our legislature took the $51 billion, which, you know, there are federal tax dollars that have been paid by Floridians. We deserve to get that money back, in our state to cover health care for people in Florida. So those are two big issues. Environment is another one. As I mentioned about the clean water, people are really beginning to connect to the damage, the devastation that's done. It's been done to the springs, to the lagoons, you know, like in Indian River, the flow into the lakes, lagoons from Lake Okeechobee, the issue of the Everglades. The bottom line is water resources, quality and quantity of water. And people, you know, you're looking all around the country right now and look at what's happening in places like California. We have major issues here, and the damage, all these areas, the springs, the lakes, Everglades, are all sources for our water supply. And if you look at the springs, I've spent a couple of days now up in Alachua and Marion County going to the springs with people like Bob Knight, who is, you know, a statewide expert on springs, and seeing the devastation that's been done because we have not, protected. We're busy, okay, after it's damaged, we put some money into it. But what we need to do is to prevent it from happening in the first place. And that deals with fertilizer runoff, with septic tanks, with all the things, you know, that are really problematic right now with this legislature and this governor.
Let me ask you a question. You were a fighter in the legislature, and we know you'll be a fighter in Tallahassee for us. We've seen recently the president kind of throw down the gauntlet and say, you know, Congress should work with him. He's done a lot to try to get Congress to work with him. But if they won't, there are things he can do as an executive to make things better. Since you might have very much a great possibility of a Republican-held legislature still, are there things that the Florida governor can do within their authority to deal with that issue, deal with that legislative gridlock that could very well be possible?
Well, there are, opportunities. This governor has actually done some of that through executive order. These are things, I mean, obviously, would have to take a closer look at it, but there are opportunities for executive order. But I would like to present it from a little different way. Unlike this governor, you know, I have a reputation for being able to work across the aisle. And I think that is important. When I look at being the Democratic leader from 2010 to 2012, when I was term limited, I only had 12 Democrats out of 40 state senators. So, you know, it doesn't take a math teacher to figure out that you have got to get your votes and work across the aisle in order to get anything done. And I was able to do that in 2012. No one thought that we were going to be able to kill the parent trigger bill, which was this privatization. And we killed it the last day of session on a 2020 vote, 12 Democrats and 8, you know, Republicans who, you know, crossed over and voted with us. Prison privatization, we had the same situation. We won that one on a 21-19 vote. And then finally, the issue of women's reproductive rights in 2020, which is an extremely important issue. And by the way, I didn't mention that in the first go-round when you talked about issues that are important. There's a big issue here about trust of particularly women who, you know, want to make sure that women's reproductive rights are protected. And in 2012, I was able to put together enough votes to be able to go to the Senate president and say to him, we have enough votes to block any legislation from coming out of committee onto the floor of the Senate. And he did not, try to do it because I told him we had the votes, and that's this is to me, you know, you work where you can. I've had the opportunity to work with some people that don't think the same way I do on a number of issues, but when it came to children's issues, when it came to guardian ad litem, when it came to background screening, ALFs, which assisted living facilities, I worked with Rhonda Storms, who certainly is, you know, far on the other side of me, to the right of me. We worked together, you know, to pass legislation. Unfortunately, the House killed it. They never took it up because the industry was able to block it. But on the Senate side, we were able to work together to do those things. So there are many issues where I really believe that I feel that I have the leadership ability to be able to do that. You know, when the governor said that he was for Medicaid expansion last session, but never did anything about it. He never even met with the Senate president or the Speaker of the House to sit down and figure out a way to compromise and to draw down the money. And then it was killed, and then after the session he went out and said, well, now he's back to being opposed to everything having to do with the Affordable Care Act. But I think leadership, I think the ability to work with people is very important, especially when you know you have divided government.
Absolutely, absolutely. I see you've been playing a good part in this clean water initiative. People have clearly been made alert to the dangers to our water supply. And another one of the dangers to Southwest Florida's water supply, and ultimately all of South Florida, is the fracking issue. How do you see that fracking issue?
Well, I have come out against the fracking issue. I, during my visit to the Springs, to Jenny Springs and several others in the Alachua area, there's a museum there, and, you know, there's kind of this model of the aquifer, and it shows, you know, because of the type of soil we have, sand, and that it's you know, what might work in North Dakota is very different in a state like Florida, where these chemicals can actually get into the aquifer and, you know, destroy our drinking water. So, you know, I have come out in strong opposition to that here. And then when I was over at Collier County, their Democratic Club 25th anniversary dinner a week ago Saturday night, there was a whole, you know, discussion about the oil, possibility of oil drilling there. Again, you know, you're dealing with a very fragile environmental situation when it comes to Florida and our aquifer. So, you know, I just think this is just not the place, you know, to have it, you know, to do it. And people are very upset over on the Southwest Coast about it.
Well, we can tell that you are showing up at places across Florida, talking to actual Democrats. As you go from place to place and build up your support out there, is there, in addition to the you know, the water quality issue and women's reproductive rights issues, and of course jobs, when you think about starting your actual governorship, are there any initial things you want to try to do? Anything you want to try to get the legislation moving on first? What's your first couple of top priorities?
Well, I would say that public education is really one of the biggest priorities, and I don't mean just K-12, although K-12 is a big focus now because of the whole high-stakes testing. I mean, you know, I feel very strongly that we need to you know, pull back from this high-stakes testing. And by the way, that's one of the things where there, you know, I know that, you know, that former Governor Crist has changed his position on many things. And, you know, one of the things that I look at is public education. For 4 years when he was governor, and we were talking about trying to eliminate the FCATs and eliminate this high-stakes testing, he went right along for all 4 years with the same kind of education reform that was brought to us by Jeb Bush and has been continued now with Rick Scott. And we have an accountability system that is broken and has failed us. And so that would be, you know, really one of my top priorities. I look at someone like former Governor Bob Graham, you know, who made a priority of getting us into the top quartile in education funding. We're down at the bottom of the bottom quartile right now in education funding. So I think that is critical for the future, you know, of our children and the future of our state. Another thing that is, I think, would be a focus of mine, is the child welfare system. You know, as you probably know, I mean, we have a situation now where over 20 children have died this year who shouldn't have died. It's tragic, and they fell through the cracks in an overwhelmed and understaffed agency that is supposed to be dedicated to their protection. And that is, again, from budget cuts where the caseloads got too high. Quality assurance positions were cut. 72 quality assurance positions were you know, slashed in the 2010 budget. And when the governor now talks, Scott now talks about, oh, you know, historic funding for child welfare, he's putting back 26 of the 72 positions. That's not historic. You know, what was historic was the cutting in the first place. So that's an issue for me, as is, by the way, the Department of Health that has just been devastated over the last two governors, both Crist and Scott. And the funding for it, the ability to react to public health issues and, you know, and be able to respond to anything that is a major public health disaster. It's a frightening situation right now, you know, where we are with our Department of Health. So these are, you know, a lot of issues. And lastly, I just want to mention also minimum wage. This is something that I have been extremely supportive of, and from the beginning. And I don't mean just the $7. You know, we went from $7.79 to $7.93. That's in our Constitution that we move up based on a cost of living. But it's not enough. It's a critical issue for Florida's families. They cannot, you know, people working a minimum wage job of $7.93 just cannot make ends meet and support their families. So Senator Bullard, who, by the way, has kindly endorsed me, Senator Dwight Bullard, has a bill to move it to $10.10. And as you know, the president talked about that in his State of the Union speech. But, you know, I was on this before the State of the Union speech, supporting Senator Bullard's bill. And, you know, my opponent had written an article, an op-ed piece in the Florida Times Union, which talked about, you know, he was comfortable with the $7.93. And as I said, that is just not enough. And now he has moved to the position of $10.10 because he said the president has supported this, so now he's supporting that. And I commend him for supporting it. But he didn't do it originally. He did it as a result, you know, of the president taking this position. This is a fairness and equality issue, and we know that the income gap and is just so dramatic in this country, and we need to do you know, to do more to make sure that everyone does have a shot at the American dream and can support their families and, you know, have good paying jobs that bring in a living wage. That's what we need to be looking at, is a living wage.
You know, so many of us who pay attention to state of Florida issues are so saddened by that archaeological dig at that former, you know, you hesitate to call it a reform school where it seems that so much brutality was taking place. And, of course, you know, almost every month we hear another horror story of a child abandoned or mistreated. Is it going to take legislation to get the appropriate funding necessary? Is it a legislative matter?
It is a legislative matter, and a governor has to show leadership and to show that this is a priority. You know, when people talk about what is the role of government, I mean, the role of government is to take care of the most vulnerable in our communities, and that would be our children in the child welfare system, our frail elderly, our developmentally disabled. I mean, I have focused on those issues as a member of the Health and Human Service Appropriation, actually vice chair for, I think, 6 out of my 8 years in the Senate. You know, when you talk about cutting taxes 24 times, my attitude is, well, how did that work out for children in the child welfare system? How did that work out for seniors, where we have the highest waiting list we've ever had, 54,000 people waiting for home and community-based care so that they don't have to go into a nursing home, but can stay in their own homes as long as they possibly can. And developmentally disabled, I have people who I've known for all my years in the legislature, 12 years, who are excited about me running because they feel that these issues and issues for children with disabilities, you know, will be a priority. You know, that's the message that I, you know, give to people. It's not about tax cuts. It's about closing loopholes, bring fairness and equity to the tax system, and fund the critical needs of the state of Florida.
Well, I sure appreciate your coming on and talking to us. There's a lot of progressives out there who are absolutely 100% behind supporting you. I got an email this afternoon from my good friends down at DFA Palm Beach saying they're endorsing you. Not surprised in the least. It's good to hear those good people behind you. And listen, we want to see you have every success, and we're looking forward to saluting you as the next governor of Florida. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I really enjoyed being with you tonight. Thanks.
Okay. Bye. Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.
So that was Senator Nan Rich, with any luck at all, future governor of Florida, telling us about her agenda up ahead. I want to play a brief piece from the situation up in West Virginia. We got a report from one of the investigators up there who was kind enough to talk to us. And let me bring him up in just a second here. Here we go. This is reporter Dan Gutman from the Charleston, West Virginia Tribune. Mr. Gutman, how are you today, sir?
I'm all right. How are you?
Do you have about 3 minutes to talk?
Sure. Who is this?
This is Richard Spezak, sir. I'm a Progressive News Network in Florida.
Okay.
And I'm very interested in the West Virginia story. My first question is this. I just read your coverage of that Capitol Hill meeting, and I thought it was very interesting. And I was wondering, of all
not Capitol Hill, the state capitol here in West Virginia.
Excuse me, the capital of West Virginia, my mistake.
Right.
But my question is this. You know, I hear about all this bottled water, and I haven't heard anyone say why this Liberty, or was it Freedom Industries, isn't covering this. Why is the public being forced to pay for this?
Well, it's a good question. You know, my guess would be Freedom is facing, you know, dozens of lawsuits and has filed for bankruptcy, and so that kind of puts a hold on all their creditors, and in the end, I don't know how much money they're going to have, so I mean, I don't know.
I was just curious because I haven't heard anyone say, you know, where the responsibility lies, and I see from the coverage that, you know, there's still plenty of unidentified matter in the water supply. I read the story about the jug and all. You know, I don't understand why there's not more pressure being brought to these guys. I understand through the bankruptcy process, they basically sold it to themselves.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, the U.S. attorney here, they're under federal investigation by them, and, you know, they've got dozens of lawsuits pending against them. And so they're not talking. They're not saying a word about anything publicly. And, you know, I don't know what this, you know, U.S. attorney investigation will find, but there is an active investigation, you know, it's the U.S. attorney, so that, you know, if he does bring charges, they would be criminal charges, not civil charges, I imagine.
Yeah, I saw another article in your paper about there's a county official was looking at maybe doing a survey of some of the other dangers to the river. And it seems to me that this should be a wake-up call to people to look at all the dangers to the water supply. Would you say that this is being taken seriously, or do you think there's a move to kind of sweep this under the rug and go back to business as usual? Because that's what the national press seems to be saying.
Taken seriously by whom?
In the state of West Virginia, by the powers that be there.
I mean, I don't really want to speculate. Yeah, I mean, I do think they're, you know, have been taking it seriously. I think they would like it to go away. but it's, you know, the water, you know, all the do not use orders have been lifted for, you know, a couple weeks now, and
has your water been affected, sir?
Yeah.
But, are you drinking the tap?
No, I'm not drinking it. You know, everybody I've talked to is not drinking it.
So this is coming out of your...
That's why they, you know, they announced yesterday, oh, we're gonna start up again distributing water. They had stopped after the do not use orders were lifted, and yesterday they said, oh, well, we're going to start up again.
And I think that's, you know, good that you can afford water. And,
right.
You know, it's great that the National Guard or the FEMA, I guess, is supplying some water as well. But, of course, there's mounting costs. And all these guys who don't want regulation, they're being suddenly silent because here we've got the socialist national government coming in and rescuing them because this local industry has betrayed the people that live there. One last question, if you don't mind. Are you going to cover that the trials there in the, or let's say the hearings?
Our paper certainly will. I don't know if it'll be me personally or more likely our court's reporter.
Well, I sure thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Just so that you know, it's Rick Spisak, S-P-I-S-A-K, from
okay.
Progressive News Network down in Florida.
Okay.
We're very interested in these environmental stories, especially one that is so clearly a canary in the coal mine, if you'll excuse my
right.
borrowing of a metaphor, because
right.
I'm afraid so many of us are faced with these industries that get off scot-free.
We shall see. I don't know what's going to happen.
Well, thanks a lot, sir. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yep.
Mr. Gunman, how are you today, sir?
Whoopsies. There we go. Another interesting story that has gotten a little bit of coverage, the president's State of the Union address last week, there was some discussion of income inequality, something that 99%ers figured out a few weeks back, as I recall. And here's Senator Elizabeth Warren weighing in on that topic.
It's somewhat counterintuitive to particularly Democratic voters that President Obama has seen a greater increase in economic inequality than prior presidents, President George W. Bush, President Bill Clinton. What's driving that?
Oh, come on. The financial crisis in 2008, when everything just fell apart and we nearly lost the whole economy, and President Obama has been trying to pull out of that throughout his terms, into his second term now, and he has not only had to fight the economic forces that pulled the economy down and fight the financial services industry, for example, that still wants its way going forward, but he's had to fight all the Republicans who have done everything they can to throw sand in the gears to make sure that this economy does not get moving again, that ordinary families, that America's middle class, working families, aren't really getting back on their feet and getting a shot.
So there you heard it from Senator Elizabeth Warren that the working people just aren't getting a shot. I think it's time for our good friend Mr. Seeger, whose work will live on. And don't forget, there is a tribute concert next Saturday down in Lake Worth. So if you're in the area, look into Lake Worth Playhouse. Has got a wonderful tribute show coming up there. Definitely you want to check that out. So here we go with another tune by the Eternal Pete Seeger.
It was back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Well, the sergeant said, sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, we'll soon be on dry ground. We were waist-deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim. Sergeant
captain, don't be a nervous Nelly. The captain said to him, all we need is a little determination, men. Follow me, I'll lead on. We were neck deep in the big muddy. The big fool said to push on. All at once the moon clouded over. We heard a gurgling cry. A few seconds later, the captain's helmet was all that floated by. The sergeant said, turn around, men, I'm in charge from now on. And we just made it out of the big muddy with the captain dead and gone. We stripped and dived and found his body stuck in the old quicksand. I guess he didn't know that the water was deeper than the place he'd once before been. Another stream had joined the big muddy about a half mile from where he'd gone. We were lucky to escape from the big muddy when the big fool sent to push on. Well, I'm not going to point any moral, I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
I heard a background story about that tune. It seems that that's one of the tunes that helped get the Smothers Brothers kicked off the air, because for some reason people concluded that when Pete Seeger was singing about the big fool, he was talking about Lyndon Johnson. But I think he was talking about all these war wonders, these guys that just glory in battle and have no objection to sending off your sons and daughters to be killed for no good reason other than to make a buck. You know, once upon a time, we used to have a term called war profiteers. But evidently, that term's gone out of favor in the Justice Department. But speaking of the Justice Department, you know, a moment ago we had talked about our friend Mr. Snowden. And I also want to mention Chelsea Manning and Julian Assange, who don't get enough mention these days, and other whistleblowers. Well, you know, there are people that suggest, and I have to concede that from time to time I'm one of them, that says that, you know, a lot of this Homeland Security crap is really just for show, that it's a useful scare tactic to keep people all freaked out. And you know, what color is the danger today, my friends? Is it an orange danger today or what? But kind of the epitome of this pantomime, this security for theater's sake, there was a real special example of that over in the UK. And I'm talking about the Snowden files that the Guardian newspaper was analyzing and publishing from time to time. And the British government, they have an Official Secrets Act, so they can they can prevent you from writing stories that deal with security. And the UK government came to the offices of the Guardian and said, hey, you know, time for discussion's over. We want you to get rid of those files. In fact, what we want you to do is to grab your computer that's got these files on it, and we want you to destroy that computer. Well, the editor and publisher said, well, it's not like they're in a box, and if we get rid of the box, it's gone. You know, these files are on the web. They're in the cloud, baby. You know, destroying a laptop, destroying a desktop computer that's got the files on it, it does nothing. And the security men say, we want you to drill a hole through the hard drive of the computer. He said, no, but I explained to you. So here's the story.
It's emerged that it was the Prime Minister who instructed Britain's most senior civil servant to tell the Guardian newspaper to destroy a computer which held files from the whistleblower Edward Snowden.
The ceremony that took place in your basement when the secret ceremony, you all just broke up the hard disks and the laptops, is that right? Is that what everyone...
Yeah, did? It's harder to break up a, smash up a computer than you might think.
The paper, which had other copies of the Snowden files overseas, agreed to take an angle grinder to the computer while the intelligence agents watched.
We had the initial pressure in which the Cabinet Secretary arrived in my office and told me we'd had enough debate on this subject. The state decrees there's been enough debate, we'll stop that. And decided to drill out the hard disks of our computers in order to stop us reporting from London.
In America, the White House spokesman was asked, would Obama ever do such a thing?
That's very difficult to imagine a scenario in which that would be appropriate.
The serious point is this, and it goes back to Spycatcher, that I was completely clear with the Cabinet Secretary that there were copies elsewhere, and that the destruction of these computers was not going to stop reporting.
It was just a public relations exercise in the end.
I wouldn't say that, but I would say it was pointless. Their aim was to stop publication and to have a dialogue of the sort that we were having, and Mr. Robbins' witness statement makes it apparent the reason they didn't go for an injunction was because they felt that we were behaving responsibly. They lost control of the documents the moment they destroyed them in London.
So, despite the fact that it was all just for show, there was no problem that what they wanted to do was to get them down there into the basement and drill some holes in some computer hard drives and take them apart and smash them because, you know, it's you know, just for show. And speaking of just for show, let's talk about solidarity with Brother Preet Seeger.
Let's sing one of Woody's old songs.
Who never was afraid, but the goons and the geeks and the company pigs and the deputy sheriffs who made the raid. And when the news was called, she went to the Union Hall. And when the Legion boys came round, she always stood her ground.
Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the Union, I'm sticking to the Union, I'm sticking to the Union. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the Union, I'm sticking to the Union, till the day I die.
Yeah.
This Union maid was wise, through the tricks of company spies, she couldn't be fooled by the company stool, she'd always organize the guys, she'd always get her way, when she struck for better pay. She'd show her card to the National Guard, and this is what she'd say. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the Union, I'm sticking to the Union, I'm sticking to the Union. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the Union, I'm sticking to the Union, till the day I die.
You women who want to be free, just take a tip from me. Join your hand with a union man into the 21st century. As Angela Davis found, we're all together bound. Let race and class and gender join to stand on common ground.
Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking with the union,
I'm sticking to the Union. I'm sticking to the Union. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the Union. I'm sticking to the Union. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the Union. I'm sticking to the Union. I'm sticking to the Union. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the Union. I'm sticking to the Union. Till the day I die. I'm sticking with the Union. Till the day I die.
Union made. Yep, that's a great one. Always a great one. While we're waiting for our next guest to call in, I want to mention our colleagues, the fellow progressive broadcasters, Gwen Holden Berry and her show Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton and his show Progress Toward Democracy, Anita Stewart, her Wise Women Media, Susan Nylon and the Nylon Report, Sita Baguil and the Sita Media, and, of course, Harriet Lerman, her Voice of the People. So I hope you support them, and of course, you know, we're always looking for sponsorship. If you can help out, like your company on air talking about the good progressive causes that we talk about, it's always good to hear from you, so drop me a note, and we can arrange to have your promotion here on the show to make sure that good progressives out there know about you and your company. And I'm expecting to hear from our next guest in just a minute, Miss Debbie Jordan, Lee County Commission candidate. So the next thing I was going to tell you while we're waiting for her to call in is the problem with the greenwashing of coal. The incident at Elk River shows that the greenwashing claims of big energy are just not true. The chemical 4-methylcyclohexane methanol was the latest and greatest chemical compound used to wash coal of its impurities to produce a, quote, cleaner exhaust from coal processing. So sooner or later, someone's going to turn this around and say, well, it's because those people insisted we have a cleaner coal. That's why this was pollution was being created. And community groups and activists have been dispelling the myth of clean coal for decades. It's nothing more than a PR distraction. And in 2008, over 1.1 billion gallons of water were polluted by toxic coal ash, leaving the town of Harriman, Tennessee, literally uninhabitable. But enough of that. I've got another good progressive candidate. Ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome Miss Debbie Jordan, candidate for Lee County Commission. Debbie, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, very good. And yourself?
I'm great. Thanks, Rick.
Well, you know, I had the good fortune to run into you at that clean water event over there in Fort Myers. Tell us a little bit about yourself, then we'll talk about the details. So tell me, Debbie, what was it in your life that made you say it's not enough to be a spectator? You want to help. You want to make this a better world.
Oh, my goodness. Where do I begin? I guess it goes back many years. As the former president of the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, I felt the need over the past years, you know, making sure that we had no drilling here and fighting to make sure that our beaches were clean to keep the tourists coming here. And not only that, you know, for my kids and my grandchildren, you know, I want them to have a great environment. I want them to be able to be educated here, to stay here, to grow here. So, you know, after seeing what has been taking place, you have to, you know, stop sitting back and you need to get involved. So I'm stepping up and I'm getting involved.
Well, good for you. How many commissioners are on the Lee County County Commission?
There's five seated.
Okay. And I'm not that familiar with Lee County. I've been mostly an East Coaster in my time in Florida. Is there a commission chair, or is there a mayor of the county who is involved in it, or is it just a county commission?
No, we have actually Lee County is represented by five county commissioners. Every year they will present a new chair and vice chair, and they stay, you know, as the chair for the year. It is a four-year seat. So right now the seat that I'm running for is County Commission District 4, which was just appointed by the governor with Brian Hammond.
I see. Let me ask you this. You know, Lee County is a coastal county. District 4, what part of Lee County is District 4?
District 4 is comprised of Fort Myers proper, North Fort Myers. It runs North Fort Myers, Fort Myers proper, Cape Coral, part of Lehigh, all the way to the Punta Gorda line. However,
wow.
The entire county do come out and vote for you.
Oh, I see. So it's countywide, huh?
Exactly.
Excellent, excellent. So, you know, I actually have some family over that way, and so I know a few things about the county. What are your primary issues as a candidate for county commission?
Well, I guess my primary is equality, the conservation, 2020, what are we doing with the taxpayers' money? Being accountable for the money that is brought in, the jobs, economic stability, our local waters, and, you know, and also, you know, business friendly. I used to own a small business, so I do understand we need to get the small businesses up and running, because when they're running, they then hire people.
Sure. How's transportation in Lee County?
Transportation has a lot to be desired. I actually have been getting on the bus, meeting the people, trying to figure out how they get from one place to the next. But I will tell you what, they will tell you how to take the bus. So it's a lot of fun. You meet interesting people. And it's not just people who can't afford to ride it. It's your elderly people who, you know, they really can't see well enough to ride. So it's safer for them to take the bus, and it's easier. But the thing is, with the sprawling here, it's a lot harder for the entire community of Lee County to utilize it. So we do have some work to do on the transportation issues.
I see. So how's the school situation there? How many high schools do you have in your district?
Oh, in my district, I have four in my district. However,
no.
I'm only keeping, that's just in my district alone, of the high schools. The middle schools and elementary schools, probably all together, is probably like 20. We have quite a few schools here, and I'm very involved in education because of the fact that even though I have four adult children, I still have 12 grandchildren that are going through the system.
Sure.
So they will never get rid of me. But it's a good thing. It's a good thing.
Well, you know, yeah. I was really very, very happy to see you at that water event, because I happen to be based in Martin County, the Caloosahatchee goes through Lee County, so Lee County suffers the same kind of pollution issues from Lake Okeechobee. Has the county commission taken a stand on the water pollution that comes from Lake O?
Not really. And I think the problem is that you get a lot of lip service, but I don't really see people doing anything about it. To me, that is something that is so vital to us. When I take my grandkids for a walk down the, you know, the Caloosahatchee, and they're looking to see the brown water, you cannot even see what's beneath that. You know, so you're thinking, you know, okay, is that really, do I want them to even get in this water? No, we sure don't. But we need to, you know, we need to be mindful of that. We need to make sure that the people who are in control of our water, they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. So, I mean, I will not back down from, you're working with the state, Washington. I don't care who I have to work with. We're going to work to make it work. The scientists just whomever needs to be involved, we need to get them involved, and we need to make these things happen.
Oh, that's great. How about the sewage system and water system? Is there a county water system or sewage system in Lee County?
Well, they have many water plants throughout Lee County. But when you go, and actually Lee County has a great tour that they take you through that will show you all the parts of Lee County, and the water plant is one of them that they will, you know, take you through for the reclaimed water and how everything is processed. And when you're in the room with the scientists and the people that are running the plant, they will tell you, well, look, they show you this clear water. Look, this is drinkable. Well, I'm not going to try to drink it. I'll let them drink it, and I'll see if they're still standing. But they show you the process, how it, you know, it gets washed through, and then how it winds up going through, you know, golf courses and then out to the Colusa. So, yes, we do have many, and I know they still have, as I said, we still have a lot of work to do with the water situation.
Now, I know a lot of Florida hasn't really built out much of a sewage collection system or treatment system, they primarily rely on septic systems and wells for well water. How is that? Do you have a sense of the balance in Lee County? Is it mostly county-supplied water and sewer service, or is it, you know, 50-50, or do you have a sense of that?
I believe that, I know personally myself, I have a septic tank. I live within the city, but I have septic. And, of course, we need to be responsible stewards of our own properties.
Absolutely.
Make sure that we are, you know, caretakers of that, because, of course, we do not want it to come back into our homes, nor do we want it to go into the water.
Right.
And the county, a lot of Cape Coral is well water. I know Sanibel still has some well water. North Fort Myers is probably a mix as well. So there's not city water within all of Lee County because of the unincorporated areas.
Sure, sure. I only raise that because, you know, it's one of the challenges in Florida, since it was built so fast, so quick, without a lot of infrastructure. You know, we can ill afford to see major industrial mistreatment of our very fragile ecological system. Now, obviously, the drilling that's taken place or that's planned for Naples hasn't yet had any impact on Lee County, has it?
Not that anybody's aware of. I know that Representative Rodriguez is pretty much supporting that. Me personally, how far do you have to dig before you hit water?
Not far.
To me, that's not a water decision. And I think that that's another thing that you need to be mindful of, you know, the homes, business, like the drilling. We've seen what happened with BP and what's happened to Florida with that. And it took us a long time to come back, and even some of the beaches are not well. So are we okay with fracking in our areas by our homes? I don't think so. And I think that's something that we need to, you know, stand firm and say, no, we're not going to let that happen here.
Well, I really like your agenda. I think it's important to draw attention to differences between a good progressive candidate with a good, well-rounded background and your opponent. If you were to talk about, just for a second, your strengths versus your opponent's strengths, how do you see that balance?
Well, I guess, first of all, I really don't know who my opponent will be as of yet. I know that I will be on the ballot. There are six that will have to go through the trials and tribulations to see who will be that the candidate to run against me. But the majority of the ones that are running, first of all, I have many years over them as far as business-wise.
Uh-huh.
And just being involved with the community and being out there. When you're looking at a 30-year-old, you know, maybe 10 years of their life, they've been maybe active in the community and what's going on around them compared to, you know, and that's what they're using, too. They're a lifelong resident, well, I've been here longer than they've been alive. So it's like, okay, beat that one. You know, I don't need a GPS to get around my area. I know my community. It's just, it drives me insane. You know, this is my, I mean, originally I'm from Philadelphia, but I've been here for over 40 years. I know this place. You know, I can be on the Facebook that says, I survived Fort Myers. I survived Lee County, and I'm still here, and I'm going, you know, I'm not going nowhere. That's what I have to offer.
Excellent, excellent. If you could kind of boil down your candidacy to the one thing you really want to work on, what would that one thing be?
One thing. I think it would be the economy.
Okay. So find ways of nourishing business, ways of developing business.
Bringing communities together where everybody can be, you know, community friendly. You can work there. You can play there. You have everything. You can live. Streamline the process so businesses can get up and started without all this paperwork.
Excellent. You know, whenever I see someone who's working to be a civil servant, and I see them out at environmental rallies, it really gives me hope, because too many times, beyond just a meet and greet, you weren't there for a meet and greet. You were there to participate, and I thought that was really should be very reassuring.
Well, thank you. And yes, when I do go to these places, this is not something that I just started doing because I became a candidate. This is something I believe in and that I have been a part of. And that's what I can say. You know, everything, feeding the community, whatever it is that I do now, I have been doing that. And that's who I am. That's the person that I am.
Well, that's excellent. Debbie, if there's a final message you want to leave to those people who are going to be wise enough to vote for you, what would that message be?
I guess it's don't be afraid of who you are, you know. If you believe that you can make a difference, you need to stand up and be that person to make the difference.
Thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome, Rick. I really appreciate you calling or allowing me to speak with you today.
Sure. Well, I hope to be able to interview you after you accept that commissionership, and you can tell us what your first things are going to be doing, okay?
I would love to, and I would love to have you there with me when that happens.
Well, thanks. Thanks very much. You have a good evening, okay?
Thank you, Rick. You too.
And best of luck.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Okay, Debbie Jordan, Lee County Commissioner for District 4. Write that down, you mental, and make sure to support her. Tell all your good friends in Fort Myers and Cape Coral they should be supporting Miss Debbie Jordan. Thanks again, Debbie, for joining us. Okay, I want to switch gears just a little bit. You know, many of us take such full advantage of the Internet. It's our research tool. It's our library. It's our recreation. Often for many of us, it's our workspace. And, that's a wonderful thing. You know, when you think about how much the Internet has gone from something that hobbyists used many years ago to a curiosity, and then a hobby, and then literally, you know, a way of life and play, work and play. So there's a danger that many of you may not have fully heard about, and it's called net neutrality. And the issue is net neutrality may be nearly over, and that's a problem. And let me play this little piece that'll explain a little bit about net neutrality.
Nation, I love the Internet, and the Internet loves me back. Why else would it offer me so much sex? That's why I was shocked last week when I heard this gossip about the Internet from its frenemy, television.
The way we use the internet could change after federal appeals court struck down net neutrality rules.
The fallout over a big decision that may change how the web works and the future of so-called net neutrality.
We could be witnessing the end of the internet as we know it.
Nation, I hope you know what this means, because I do not. Maybe the TV knows.
Net neutrality is the idea that broadband internet service providers, Comcast, Time Warner Cable, Verizon, and others should treat everything that flows across the internet equally.
Thanks, TV. You see, under net neutrality, every site on the internet has to be equally accessible to the user, whether it be a huge behemoth like Google or some obscure little mom-and-pop site like Bing. But folks, this recent court ruling ends all of that.
Net neutrality advocates say this ruling could also allow internet service providers to slow everything and then charge you extra to allow faster access to a particular site like Amazon.
You might have to pay more for a specific website. There are a million different ways that you might have to pay.
Folks, I will not stand for my content being held hostage for cash. Yeah. Must rise as one against the cable companies and... Folks, I've rethought my position on net neutrality. What I meant to say was, like all Americans, I love my cable company. They add so much to my life. For instance, all the time I get to spend with my family during the 3 minutes it takes for my DVR to process a channel change. And it'll be better. Think about it. Verizon says this ruling allows broadband providers to offer new and innovative services to their customers while allowing more room for innovation and keeping the internet a hub of innovation. See? Net neutrality's only been dead a week, and already three innovative uses of the word innovation. It used to have to mean something. Folks, I'm so inspired. Folks, I am so inspired by this new paradigm of holding content hostage that I've implemented a few innovations of my own here at The Rapport, such as my new Twofinity phone service, where my employees continue to enjoy unfettered access to the first two digits of any number they dial. Are you on fire? Then just dial 9-1. Need another one? Reasonable charges apply.
And there we go. We heard from a variety of smokes models. And hopefully you
tomato?
Can understand the
Old El Paso says diced tomatoes, standing stuff, chicken.
Net neutrality much better. Okay, next up, we're going to listen to a letter to the editor written by the head of the Chemical Safety Board. Okay, the United States is facing an industrial chemical safety crisis. The horrifying chemical spill that recently contaminated the drinking water of hundreds of thousands of people in West Virginia is the latest in a series of disasters and near misses across the country. It seems to me, as chairman of the independent federal agency charged with investigating industrial chemical accidents, that urgent steps are required to significantly improve the safety of the nation's chemical industry, an industry vital to our economy yet potentially dangerous to those who live near the thousands of facilities that process or store hazardous chemicals. Those facilities include ones like the Chevron refinery in Richmond, California, where aging, corroding pipes resulted in a huge fire August 2012, the fertilizer plant in West Texas, where stores of ammonium nitrate exploded last year and laid waste to a large part of the town, killing more than a dozen people, sifting through chemical plant rubble from catastrophic accidents year after year. Our board has long called on regulators to require and for the industry to adopt what is known as inherently safer technology. By this, we mean using safer designs, equipment, and chemicals, minimizing the amount of hazardous chemicals stored and used, and modifying and simplifying processes to make them as safe as practical. Now, While there's now at last a strong current within the industry to adopt these safer technologies as a best practice, many still oppose any actual regulatory requirements, arguing that they're too costly and prescriptive. We can't wait for corporations to volunteer because accidents continue, often with devastating consequences. What we need is a comprehensive regulatory reform. But achieving safety reforms is complicated and time-consuming. In the interim, the Environmental Protection Agency should step in, use its power under the Clean Air Act's General Duty Clause to compel chemical factories to take steps to make their operations inherently safer. The law assigns owners and operators of these facilities a general duty to identify hazards, design and maintain safe facilities, and minimize the consequences of leaks. The EPA should follow up by adopting specific regulations to meet those goals. 12 years ago, the EPA's administrator, Christine Todd Whitman, proposed regulations that would have encouraged producers and users of high-risk chemicals to find safer alternatives or processes. But her proposal stalled in the face of strong opposition from American companies, which are already required to use safer technology and other risk reduction methods at their European operations. Insurance data indicates that the loss from refinery accidents, for instance, are at least 3 times lower in Europe than in the U.S. In 2012, Ms. Whitman urged the agency to use the Clean Air Act to require safer technology before a tragedy of historic proportions occurs. The EPA said recently it was considering just such an approach. The agency's own National Environmental Justice Advisory Council has urged it to issue new rules to reduce the danger and imminent threat posed by chemical plants, manufacturing, and transport. Across the nation, an estimated 13,000 facilities store or process chemicals in amounts hazardous enough to endanger the public, according to the EPA. But that estimate underestimates the dimensions of the problem. For example, the West Virginia facility implicated in the recent spill, which stored chemicals used in the coal industry, would not even fall under criteria used by the agency to come up with its estimate. Consider how a requirement forcing safer practices and technology might have prevented the 3 accidents I mentioned. The Chevron refinery would have been required to replace aging, corroded pipes with safer, corrosion-resistant material that almost certainly would have prevented the rupture that endangered 19 workers caught in the initial vapor cloud, not to mention the smoke plume that sent 15,000 Bay Area residents to the hospital. The refinery industry accident rate overall is unacceptably high. The agricultural chemical company in West Texas could have used safer storage practice and safer fertilizer blends and kept far less ammonium nitrate on site. The lives of more than a dozen firefighters and residents could have been spared, and the widespread damage to homes, schools, the nursing home, and other structures would have occurred. The decades-old chemical storage tank in West Virginia that leaked as much as 10,000 gallons of chemicals used in the coal processing into the nearby Elk River contaminated the water supply of some 300,000 Charlton area residents. Could have been moved or replaced by modern anti-leak storage tanks and safer containers. After the West Texas explosion, President Obama urged and issued an executive order requiring federal agencies to review safety rules at chemical factories, chemical facilities. I am strongly encouraged by the White House leadership on this issue. The EPA is working with other agencies to comply, but in the meantime, the agency has the authority to act now on its own to require inherently safer design, equipment, and processes that would go a long way toward preventing more catastrophes. That was a letter to the editor in the New York Times by Rafael More Erazo, chairman of the United States Chemical Safety Board. I would urge you, my friends, to check out what facilities are endangering your water and life. And now, without any further ado, I'd like to bring you Eric Gooden, Boca Raton City Council Chair, Seat B candidate. Ladies and gentlemen, help me welcome Mr. Eric Gooden. Welcome, Eric.
Hi, Rick. How are you? Thank you so
very
much for
good,
giving
sir.
Me this opportunity to talk to you.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure, sir. So tell us. Tell us a little bit about what makes Eric Gooden tick.
What makes me tick, that's a good question. The reason why I wanted to run for Boca Raton City Council was because of my experience that I had in D.C. and you know, my determination and motivation from working in D.C. with a congressman really exciting me to run. And that's, you know, what makes me kick, to answer the question, is, you know, being a voice for the people. And that's what I want to do.
What congressman did you work with, sir?
I worked for a congressman from Michigan, Sandy Levin.
Excellent, excellent. So, you know, for most people, you know, living a life, having some friends, making something like a living, that's a full plate and then some. But it takes a rare individual to say, okay, listen, I'm also going to try to help. I'm going to try to make this a better world. What was it in your life, sir, that made you go that extra mile to say, I want to help. I want to make a difference. Obviously, your experience with a congressman, but you know, when did you start participating in this larger civic sphere?
And after the automobile crisis happened in Detroit, my uncle lost his job due to outsourcing. And during that time, I moved in with my grandma to care for her, and I worked numerous jobs. And, you know, and I just seeing it on TV, you know, just, you know, the crisis and, you know, about, you know, outsourcing and, you know, just being, I wanted to be more involved in the community because of it. And that's what really inspired me to run.
Oh, that's great. There's nothing like caring for an elder to help you appreciate, you know, what society really needs, what's important, and what's a real value. Let me ask you this. I see on your issues page that you list number one, economic development. What do you think needs to be done to help Boca be more, have more economic development, have more jobs?
Okay, the start would be focusing on smart growth and development. And what I mean by that is, I mean that the permitting process for small businesses needs to be more streamlined and more efficient. And in order for the goal, for this goal to happen, we need to take full advantage of the valuable personnel in Boca Raton with the three universities, Lynn University, FAU, and Palm Beach State, because they are the future, and these are future entrepreneurs, they're future doctors, future lawyers, and I feel that in order, you know, this, if we accomplish all these things, you know, that can really gear towards economic development.
Well, good. Obviously, you appreciate education because you mentioned the schools first. How does a city encourage education? What kind of levers or what kind of assistance can a city provide the educational facilities within it? Because many people think of the state really as the interface with the or the county. How can a city help education?
The city can help in numerous ways, but the main issue would be being a voice and advocate. And
right.
As a city councilman, I will be that voice. And I will go to these universities. I will also go in front of the Palm Beach County School Board and talk to the officials there to make, you know, better opportunities for everyone.
Excellent. I also see you have an interest in public safety. And if I recall, there was a mention of you liking to see a better use of technology in the public safety arena.
Yes, I come from a family of, you know, police officers, firefighters. So, you know, it's I have a strong passion for, you know, public safety issues, and I feel that, you know, in the city of Boca Raton, we need a more balanced approach, and we need to put them first as well at all times.
Excellent. Let me go ahead and ask the question. Are there areas of Boca that have crime issues, or is there a need for more youth resources to keep kids engaged so they don't get involved in troublesome activity? Does the city have some programs like that?
The city has numerous programs for it, but I feel that we need more programs. We need to inform, you know, the public of those opportunities, and also with the public safety issue, it's more of traffic congestion and issues like that, where it puts, you know, making people accessible.
Uh-huh.
Mostly the main issues. that are happening in Boca.
Okay. And then lastly, you mentioned the Boca Raton city budget. Do you think that there's some issues where the Boca budget should be could be spent better?
Yes, I do. Actually, one of the weaknesses in the city budget is that the city is cutting hours of city employees to avoid health care expenses. And this happens, this results in two people having to do the same job that is done by one. And it also creates, you know, greater employee turnover and also higher training expenses as well.
Yeah, you know, when companies try to save money by abusing their employees, literally there's very little to be gained that way, that's for sure. If you were to say the reason that people should vote for you because of this issue or because of your stand, what would that be? What would that issue be that's really your issue?
If I had to choose one of the issues above,
sure,
that I'm passionate about, the main issue is smart development and smart growth. That's one of, you know, my most important issue in my platform.
Well, let me ask you this.
Because I feel that the residents need to be put first in all discussions. And, you know, I've spoken to numerous residents about this issue, and a lot of them said we need someone in there that can be a voice for us in the community. And that's what I want to do.
Good. You know, a lot of times we hear that public participation in municipal activities, you know, for example, let's say some cities have their public meetings at an inconvenient time, or they're closed, or participation is severely curtailed. Does Boca right now have their hearings, the city meetings, on TV or on the internet streamed?
Yes, they currently do.
Well, good, good. How's participation? Is there pretty good participation in city government with the public?
I feel that we need more education, better ways to inform the public on what a city council does and do. And I feel like that's really where it's lacking.
I see. I see. Well, let me ask you this. If people want to help you and support your campaign, how can they get in touch with you? How can they support the campaign?
They can support my campaign by visiting my website. It's www.ericgooden2014.com. And it has all my information on there about my issues and also a link to donate.
Excellent. And let me ask you one final question, if I may, sir. When you think back in history, whether American history or world history, could you name one or two political leaders that you think really stand out in your mind as someone who's done the right thing for their community?
It would be, if I had to name an elected official?
Sure.
Okay. It would probably be the President of the United States. It would be Barack Obama.
I see. He certainly
he was a community organizer, and he, you know, he was about the community. You know, when he first ran for public office, he was a community organizer. He put the people, he voiced the people's concerns that were in the community.
Well, thank you so much, sir. I sure wish you the best of luck, and we'll have to have you back. When is your election?
My election is March 11th.
March 11th. Well, come on back on when you're a city commissioner, or excuse me, city council member, and we'd love to have you tell us about what you're going to be doing to actually put those plans into place. Thanks again.
Thank you so much, Rick, for giving me this opportunity.
It's our pleasure, sir. We always want to support good progressive candidates. Have a good evening, sir, and thanks again.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you know, we've had some great guests, but now I'm going to bring you a guest that is really, it's going to tug at your heartstrings pretty serious. I'd done a series of interviews with some people involved in the Elk River catastrophe, and I tell you, my first reaction is there, but for the grace of God, go every one of us. Because right now, the way the laws are written, the way the legislators are bought and sold, there's very little, very, very little standing between you and I and the profit motive out there with people who are just prepared to trash the planet. But this is an activist from the Ohio River Environmental Coalition, Miss Vivian Stockman, and she's right there in the heart of Charleston, and I want you to hear her voice because I think it's going to touch you. Hello, Vivian.
Hey, Richard.
How are you tonight?
I am fair to middling.
Well, good. Listen, I really appreciate you taking a few minutes out to talk to our audience. I'd like to introduce Vivian Stockman of the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, great. Vivian, you guys have a rough row to hoe right now. Could you tell us how you first heard about this terrible spill on the Elk River?
Well, pretty much as soon as it happened, we were notified and getting notices to not drink the water and to go out and get bottled water. And in Charleston that evening, there was a mad dash for bottled water.
Did it infect your home?
No, I was in town when that happened. I live about an hour away, though, but I'm often in Charleston staying over and working for extended periods.
Okay, great. Now, we've heard a variety of stories. As you can imagine, national press doesn't cover this issue at all, hardly. The occasional mention, of course, that everything's bankrupt. Don't look here. There's nothing to see. let me ask you a couple other questions. Now, I understand FEMA has been providing some water to the communities, but also there was reports that another organization was providing water also, but some of the water that was given out was actually some of the same tainted water. Is that true?
That's right. The West Virginia American Water apparently sent out some tanker trucks with the tainted water because people started getting the relief water and noticed the same licorice-type smell that first tipped people off to that there was a problem. So, yeah, it was pretty amazing that your relief water would be the same tainted water.
Now, needless to say, most progressive environmental activists are happy to see at least some remediation being done, people getting some potable water, some drinking water. But, you know, I want to ask a deeper question. Constantly, whenever environmentalists are called to action because of these terrible abuses, we're told that it's regulation that's the enemy. Now, are you hearing that same kind of protective talk of the corporations? Are you hearing that, you know, it's the overregulation that's damaged it, and if we regulate these industries, they're going to be driven out of West Virginia? Are you hearing that yet, or is people still in shock?
Well, it's been quite a wake-up call for people, and people that who ordinarily would say, you know, they don't want the government in their lives and whatnot are clamoring for the water, and a lot of folks have actually been out at meetings and infuriated at the lack of regulation. And, you know, politicians have been running scared. Funny thing happened yesterday. The West Virginia Coal Association was having their annual symposium, and the West Virginia governor has, you know, and I think it's like a 60-year some history, and the West Virginia governor almost always speaks there. And yesterday our governor didn't speak there. And some of the, you know, we came out with some protests yesterday, and got several legislators were telling us that they were glad to see us in the state house, and a few actually were wrangling with us, and they did have on their Friends of Coal lapel, but at the moment anyway, because the crisis is still unfolding, there's not a lot of folks that are saying we don't need more regulation or at least enforcement of the existing regulations. Now, as soon as it happened, Boehner and House was saying something to those effects, but most of our state politicians are treading a little lightly right now because, you know, never before have we really had 300,000 people all impacted at once, and that's a good chunk of your voting population there. So,
absolutely. Listen, another question I want to ask you is,
I saw a story in your local Charleston paper saying that a Kanawha County emergency staffer, Mr. Hardy, says that maybe we should, you know, start looking at what other dangers there are to our water supply. Do you think that there's going to be some remediation? Do you think that they're actually going to take this a little more seriously now?
Well, we're called Kanawha County, and, well, there's definitely a real outcry now, and there's been some folks like Evan Hansen from Downstream Strategies, folks with West Virginia Rivers Coalition, some of the groups like My United Group that have been working on chemical problems. You know, folks are saying, look, we have had the Chemical Safety Board here previously two other times before this time, and they came out with these grand recommendations that actually have been working out in California in terms of getting local input on watching these type of facilities. So this one really is getting people's attention.
I understand. Let me ask you a question. Now, we've heard stories. There's, you know, little dribs and drabs of a story like this tend to get out. There was a story that people were smelling this licorice smell in their water way before, even back to Christmas time.
Yeah, there's you know, there's more unanswered questions than answered at this time. And, you know, what just recently came out, oh, well, it's probably that leak was going on at least 20 hours. And we really still need to figure that out. It could be have been even more. The other night at a town hall meeting, there was a woman that stood up and said she's been having these kind of rashes and headache-type symptoms that a lot of people are experiencing, and those symptoms include nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. And she said she's been having them for quite some time. And, you know, thank God this thing had a smell, and it got to a certain point where you could actually smell it, because we could have had all these people reporting to the hospitals and doc-in-a-box places and saying, you know, we might not even know what was causing all this.
Now, I understand that you had a friend, Dustin, who brought some of this water from his own tap to a legislative session. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, that happened yesterday. My coworker, Dustin White, he's been staying a lot with his father in Boone County. His father is very sick, and he and his sister are taking care of him. And they're on this municipal water all the way out in Boone County that was under the Do Not Use advisory. And the water that he tried to bring in was brown and smelled of licorice and also bleach. And he was trying to bring in this jug of water, and the security at the state capitol said, you can't bring that in. We don't know what it is. And he said, it's my tap water. You know, it's my father's tap water. I want to bring it in. I want to show the legislators what we're still dealing with in the outlying counties. And they would not let him bring it in until finally we went and got one of the delegates who came out and got it and took it in and he's going to have it tested. He wanted to make clear that he was just doing this in this one case, and people need to try to figure out other ways to get their own water tested. But what was going on at the door there was they were trying to, they told Dustin if he brought this water in, he would be arrested.
Yeah, probably. Him bringing that water to the legislature makes him a criminal. Them dumping the water into the river, that's no problem.
Right, absolutely. We've gone through this type of thing before. Absolutely.
Let me ask
and
you this.
Go ahead.
No. You can go ahead and finish
your story. Well, you know, that water is coming into the state capitol, too. It's like, you guys are letting this be piped in here. Why can't you just have it come in? It may be looking clear coming through the state capitol, but that's the problem that people are experiencing. It depends on your pipes. It depends on your hot water heater. It depends on where you are in the system. You know, this flushing that they're recommending to, like, turn on your tap and let everything go out, there's great concern that this has not actually cleared the chemical out, and it could be adhering to the pipes, it would be stuck in your tank, it could be fluctuating even at the plant, the municipal water supply, because they have not cleaned it, they haven't changed the filters, they haven't, you know.
Are you kidding?
That's what the Dr. Gupta, or the, actually no, an expert associated with Aaron Brockovich was saying at the town hall the two nights ago. You know, they just haven't gone through the proper procedures. There's an expert on this up from the University of Alabama looking at the flushing. Several scientists are very concerned. There's a video of Dr. Ben Stout looking at, you know, somebody going through the flushing process, and just, you could just see this stuff roiling in the water. And, you know, people are still reporting sick. People are still reporting fumes. People are still not wanting to use the water and not trusting the information that's coming from officials, because every day something new is coming out, and it's just, as Aaron Brockovich said at the town hall the other night, a cluster B.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. I understand that the call that everything's safe was based on research, a single study of rats done by the actual manufacturer of the chemical Kodak many years ago, and that the CDC calls that study really insufficient science to base any calls on. Now, I understand that they've modified that since, and they're saying now you should ask your local doctor, as if your local doctor has better resources than the CDC. How was that kind of remark greeted in the town hall meetings?
Well, you know, that people are so angry, and even if the officials had bothered to say, you know what, we don't really know from the get-go, we don't really know. You know, more and more they're coming out and saying, well, there's a lot that we don't know. It's hard to find the information on this. The big thing in the town hall meeting the other night was, we are the lab rats. There's never been this big of...
Unfortunately.
Yeah, there's never been this big of an experiment. And then the National Science Foundation today recommended... Or there was news out today that they were giving some money out for three different rapid research projects, and because, you know, basically the one fellow that they quoted in their press release had said, you know, this is the largest man-made environmental disaster of this century.
I guess that's not counting the BP spill in the Gulf. That's not counting the spill in Arkansas. I'm not counting the spill. It's amazing. I heard someone make a comparison that if this was done by terrorists, there'd be, you know, the National Guard would be there. And
well, many people have thought that and said that out loud, and, you know, it just shows how skewed our priorities can be sometimes. You know, we let industry do pretty much just have its way with our air and water and our lives, and, you know, that's all in the name of profit, but meanwhile, you know, some theoretical thing that might happen sometime, we're just throwing all this at, all this money at, and all these, you know, sacrificing of our assorted rights. But,
well, Vivian,
you know,
I want to thank you so much for joining us. If there's one thing you would say to environmentalists across the country, what would you say?
I would say that, you know, I think we're all seeing it, that water is the issue that unites us all across all these different polluting industries, and that, you know, I'm pretty sure everybody working against fracking, on climate change issues, on issues of income inequality, all types of these issues, underlying it all is the way we're letting profit override people.
Well, from one lab rat to another, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot.
And please keep us informed, Vivian. We thank you so much, and best of luck with your efforts. We're pulling for you.
All right, take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Vivian Stockman, the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So you heard it from a person who lives in the area. Now, who's upstream from your water supply? I told you that there's a county official up there who said, maybe we should do a survey of what other chemicals are like endangering our waters. There were people who were saying they were smelling this stuff and tasting this stuff and getting the kind of skin reactions months earlier. So, friends, we have to pull together. We have to pull together. This is a piece from Esquire about formaldehyde from February 1st, from just yesterday. It's been very amusing to watch local politicians and government officials in West Virginia try to comfort their constituents while simultaneously keeping faith with the corporations whom they've been working out, who they've been whoring out the state for two centuries, including the hilarious named and now conveniently bankrupt Freedom Industries, which poisoned all the water in the state. Scott Simonton, a Marshall University environmental engineer, told a legislative committee Wednesday that he found cancer-causing formaldehyde, which he said is one possible breakdown product from the chemical, in a local water sample, and that the continued lack of data on the chemicals that leaked into the Elk is very concerning. "It's frightening," he said. "It's really frightening," said Simonton, who is a member of the state's Environmental Quality Board and also consults for at least one local law firm that's filed suit over the leak. "What we know scares us, and there's a lot more that we don't know." Gee, that sounds bad. Wait, there are some people from the state to reassure us. Letitia Tierney, commissioner of the Bureau for Public Health, said Wednesday night that the chemists in the state had consulted with all say the formaldehyde couldn't have come from the MCHM. In other words, from that leak on the Elk. "Our experts are all in agreement that it's unlikely that his findings are in any way related to the chemical spill," she said. "It's already in our environment. The formaldehyde in your water is not from the spill. Formaldehyde in your water is from somewhere else. Formaldehyde in your water, what, that's the new normal?" Andrew Welton, an environmental engineer from the University of South Alabama, drove to West Virginia after the leak. He and his team of researchers have been taking water samples and helping residents complete the flushing process. But they use a different set of guidelines than the state and West Virginia American recommended. For example, Welton emphasized that residents should open their windows during the flushing process and use ceiling or floor fans to push the chemical fumes outside. Oh, it's so much better when the chemical fumes are outside. Welton also suggested shutting off hot water tanks before the flushing because chemicals in the water will evaporate faster into your home or living room from hot water than from cold. In an interview, Welton said it's crucial that officials begin testing and sampling inside people's homes to determine the level of contamination of plumbing systems and then what to do about it. "I can't believe they're not doing this," he said. "The issues aren't being addressed. The long-term consequences of this spill are not being addressed." I can believe it, and so apparently can the people in Cincinnati. Matthew Davis was among those still waiting for the ban to be lifted. After rinsing off in a creek last week, he finally enjoyed a hot shower Tuesday at his fiance's house 30 minutes away. Davis had his wisdom teeth removed just before the water ban. "Pretty much all I had was Coke," he said. And that hurt. Ladies and gentlemen, what you see here, whether it be the fracking issue or the pollution from the oil pipelines, the poisoning of rivers from railroad spills, these are issues we can ill afford to ignore. And we can't fight them separately. We have to work together. We have to pull together to make these things better. And the reason this show exists, to give progressive activists a chance to speak out, to tell the story of what they're doing, to talk about the work that they do, to talk about how we can work together. This is what PNN is all about. And when we bring these people to the air to you, we bring them because we think this is information that you need to know about. So turn to your friend,
Turn to your neighbor. Turn to the activists you know. Talk to your neighbor. We need to work together to make sure that they don't get away with the fracking. They don't get away ignoring radioactivity in lakes and dredging. Make sure that we work together. As Pete said, candidate Eric Gooden has received a DFA endorsement for his candidacy for the Boca Raton City Council. So, DFA, those good people in Palm Beach County, they're supporting it. I hope you will.
The whole wide world around, the whole wide world around. Montgomery, Alabama, says we are not afraid. And here you and I up here, and like every human being in the world, we have been afraid. But you still sing it. We are not afraid. We are not afraid.
We are not afraid. We are
Ladies and gentlemen, that wraps it up for tonight's show. Thanks so much for joining us. And let's let Paul Paul Robeson sing us out. Thanks, Paul. ¶¶
I dreamed I saw Joe here last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead, I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, just as I am standing by my bed, they framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. It's more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, smiling in his eyes, says